It does.
This is what we call the Miguel Show Uncensored. My name is Miguel Fuller.
I'm Holly O'Connor.
I am producer Jared.
Yes, and we are your morning show on the new Hot 101.5. All right, so we're switching things up. Sorry, we're switching things up a little bit because Holly had a suggestion. We're stealing an idea from some guys that work here at Cox Media Group Tampa.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing, Holly?
We are doing sort of the backstory of each one of us, but not all in the same podcast. So we're going to start with Miguel. And I got it. I have to give shouts out to The Crowded Table, John Senning and Dennis and Jake. And they do a podcast, The Crowded Table. And so I was listening to one of their podcasts and they did what they call The Origins of Dennis. And I was like, well, this is pretty fascinating. And then I thought, of course, we should probably do that.
Steal it.
So we straight up. But I did tell both of them, and I hadn't seen Jake to tell him, but I told both of them that we were ripping it off, and they were fine with it as long as we gave them a shout out.
Oh, okay. Oh, so you can where can you download their podcast? Where do you listen to it, Holly?
I get it from their Twitter. Like, they tweet out where you listen, and then I just click the link.
Yeah, and it's always at 6:01 for some reason.
Yes, it is. Okay, so let me pull up because now I feel bad. So hold on a second.
Oh,
I
wanna, dear.
No,
here
I wasn't
go.
Ready. Well, I'm sorry.
It's take forever. What's their Twitter account?
Well, I just follow. If you want to, that's what I'm looking right now.
Oh my gosh. Oh.
Okay, you can find their Twitter account at 1ONE Crowded Table.
There you go.
One Crowded Table. And then you can follow that. You can follow them from there. You can get their stuff. So I got the Origins idea from them, and we decided to do it, but we're going to call ours The Prologues.
The Prologues. Yeah, you know, before the story begins in a book.
I love that, by the way. So.
The Prologue. The Miguel Show's Prologues.
Mm-hmm.
Mine begins.
Yeah, we're starting with Miguel.
With rape. Just had to go ahead and put that on the table.
You might as well.
Mm-hmm. So what do I mean by that? I haven't talked about that yet on our show on Hot 101.5. I normally do something around Father's Day, which I didn't want to do last year because I felt like it was too soon.
Yeah, we had just we'd only been on the air for like 2 months.
Yeah, like when you meet people, you don't just sort of spill your guts, you know, the first time. And so I felt like it was too soon to sort of talk about that. But what do I mean by rape? That's how I was started as a human being.
Conceived. I think the word is that you're looking for.
I couldn't think of. I was going to say intimidated, but
no, not you.
No, I wasn't intimidated. That's awkward. Anyway, so basically, here's how this unfolded from my perspective. Growing up with my mom, she was a single parent, and my dad, his name is Michael Fuller. And so my whole life, Michael Fuller was my dad, who actually lives, I don't know if he still does, in Clearwater, Florida. I actually visited him when I was like 5 in Clearwater here in Florida.
And how long were your mom and Michael Fuller together?
I think they were together maybe for like a year or so.
But he still took you on as his own.
Yeah, so what happened is, Michael Fuller was my dad, and we lost contact with him right after middle school. And so when I was a senior in high school, I was like, where is Michael Fuller?
Mm-hmm.
Like, do I have brothers and sisters? I'm about to go to college. Can I get some money from him? Like,
right.
You know, these are some questions I need to be answered. And so one tearful day when my mom was driving me to actually meet up with a high school boyfriend, my mom, I was like, so where is Michael? I really would like to find out. And she broke down crying and she goes, Michael Fuller is not your dad. And I was like, what are you talking about? And so then she begins to tell the story that back in 1984, she worked downtown Atlanta and she was raped. And she was on her way to work on a graveyard shift in downtown Atlanta. And so then she found out a few weeks or months later that she was pregnant. But at the time, she was dating Michael Fuller. So they didn't know who the baby was. And I don't know if back then you could, you know, if you could do, I don't think DNA testing was around to be
not
able to tell.
Not as easily available, certainly, if it was.
No, so they couldn't tell. And so Michael Fuller said, well, it doesn't matter. This is my child. And so in comes to the world Miguel Fuller.
Mm-hmm.
I was born into the universe. And so I, of course, my mom, like, she has a hard time being with anyone. And so they broke up shortly after I was born, but I still had his last name, but they never knew who was the daddy. Mm-hmm. And so then when my mother and I lived in Denver when I was in middle school, she went through this really bad depression phase where she lost her job and she was on antidepressants. And so she went on welfare and she wanted to get child support from Michael Fuller. Well, he was like, I don't know if that's my child. I'm not paying out money if that's not my child. And so I remember being taken out of school, going to this nondescript building in downtown Denver and having my mouth swabbed, which I didn't know what for.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It was for a DNA test because that was around 96 where DNA testing was starting to be prevalent then. So all I remember is a few weeks after that, my mom delved into a deeper depression where she literally would not come out of her room. And I didn't know what was going on. She got through it. Now fast forward to we're in the car and she's telling me this story. And she said that's when she found out that Michael Fuller was not my father. It was the rapist. Mm-hmm. And so she's like crying and I'm like trying to console her. And I'm like, you know, obviously that was a painful experience for you, but it doesn't change anything about my life because I've never grown up with a dad. So I don't even know what to miss if I were to miss something.
Mm-hmm.
It's just now that sort of leaves like a whole lot of questions about, you know, am I just black? Do I have any other ethnicities? Mm-hmm. Are there any health problems that I'm going to encounter later on? Am I going to be painfully bald one day? I mean, so there's all these do I have brothers and sisters? There are all these other questions about, you know, when you are a product of rape when you don't know who the person is. I just don't know.
Man, that would just, how does it not drive you nuts? Do you just not focus on it?
I honestly feel like since I don't, like there's literally no way for me to even try to figure out, then it's like, why even worry about it?
Yeah.
Like there's, I mean, because I had a friend one time who said that maybe you should go to like Atlanta, the city of Atlanta, and do like maybe if there's like a DNA match with criminals and see if you can do some sort of thing like
possible.
That. But I've just never really wanted, I'm like, I don't care. I mean, maybe one day if I have children,
yeah.
I want to know for mm-hmm. their sake
sure.
who, you know, that heritage or that DNA comes from.
Right.
But outside of that, I've just really never wanted to know, so it doesn't affect me. I think what it sort of solidified for me was my mom always said that compared to my brother, I was a happy child. Like she said that I barely cried. I was always bouncy and smiley. Mm-hmm. And even now, you know, I smile even in the most uncomfortable moments. And I'm just a happy, naturally happy person. And I think because I came from such a like negative act, that's why sort of in my soul, at my core, is peace and happiness. And that's sort of where everything else comes from because it was created from such evil.
Mm-hmm. But see, it could have so easily gone the other way.
Yeah, it's true. But I think that just goes to show you a lot of who you are is predetermined.
Yes.
And a lot is learned from your environment. But I also feel like a lot of it comes from just who you are naturally. Because my brother and I had both the same upbringing.
Your environment was similar.
But mm-hmm. he came from, you know, my brother was born, my mom was with his dad, and so he came from a nuclear home,
mm-hmm.
and he had everything that, you know, I could have had, if not better. Because even when my mom was divorced from her dad and I came along, my brother would still, like, get money and clothes and stuff from his dad, and
yeah.
I'd be like, well, that'd be nice. I wish I got some stuff from Michael Fuller.
Right.
Yeah. You know, but he turned out the way he is, where he is in jail right now,
mm-hmm.
and I turned out the way I am mm-hmm. on the fourth-rated morning show in Tampa Bay.
Yay! it's very fascinating to me. So that's the early beginnings.
Yeah, so that's sort of who I feel like shaped me at my core.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some other things that's happened along my life that I feel like have sort of been sort of turning points or like big moments, excuse me, that I feel like I went through a metamorphosis. And one of those is when I first came out to the very first person that I ever talked to about it. I was a sophomore in high school. And I always describe that when you're in the closet, it's like every thought you have is centered around being gay and being found out. And I remember being in class this particular afternoon when I was a sophomore in high school, and I was writing on my paper, and I was like, I think I'm writing too gay. I think my head is tilted to the right, and that's probably too gay.
Did you know what that meant? To be gay by then? You knew what
then,
that meant?
Yeah, I figured that out when I was in seventh grade watching The Real World.
Okay.
Watching The Real World Miami, and it was Dan, the gay character. And I remember he was sitting on a dock with the guy, and they kissed. And he was like, oh my God, this is the first person that I liked. And I was like, that's what the kids have been calling me. That's what gay is. Huh. My life is going to be different. And so that's when I had that first thought. And so then through middle school and early high school, I know that. And I just hadn't told anyone. I didn't feel comfortable yet. But I remember just all these thoughts of, I'm going to be found out that I'm gay. I'm gay, sure. gay. And then one day, I was at lunch, and my friends and I were outside of the cafeteria, and I just literally fell down on the floor. And I started crying, and I was like, I can't anymore. I can't handle it. And my friends were like, what the actual fuck?
Oh, man.
Sorry, we're in the Dove studio.
Okay.
And it's George Michael.
Well, what had come up that you fell out on the floor? I mean, it wasn't out of nowhere.
I don't remember what the conversation. I think it was just the overwhelming thought of, you always are thinking about being found out as gay. And if whatever you're doing is too gay. You know, and that's why a lot of times you find that people will say, well, when Miguel came out, he went from being like masculine to super gay. And it's not that you went from being super gay, you just started to be yourself.
Yeah.
And not to say that every gay person is like that, but you can just be more comfortable in your skin.
You're not putting on a front anymore.
Exactly. And so putting on that front was just too much. And so my friends took me to the counselor's office, and I remember sitting in Ms. Bleacher's office. And there was one gay kid that we had there. His name was Reagan. And she was like, well, what's wrong with you? What's wrong? And I said, I think I'm like Reagan. And she said, okay, well, what does that mean to you? And so then we went into this discussion, and I was just like crying everywhere. And I just, she finally calmed me down. And I remember I walked back into my media tech class, and I remember sitting down in class, looking around at everyone and thinking, I'm free.
What a weight to have lifted.
It literally was like 100 pounds on my shoulders had been lifted. And so then over the course of the next 2 years, I started to come out to more and more people.
Mm-hmm.
But in that process, what sort of solidified me coming out and saying, okay, this is who I am. By the time I was a junior in high school, I had told most of my friends, and it was like well known pretty much by then that I was gay. And so I decided yet again to try to run for class president, because I had run my freshman year, my sophomore year, my junior year, those first 2 years, and I had lost.
Yeah.
And I tried different tactics. The sophomore year, I even joined up with the girl that was semi-popular, Corey, and I was like, well, maybe I'll get some of her people to vote for me. I was very shrewd back then.
You're very shrewd now.
Yes, I am, girl. I was like, we gonna make it happen, and then we lost.
Oh.
But then that end of junior year, I was up against four other people, and three of those people were popular guys. Like, these were people that played lacrosse and football. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to win. Like, I'm the kid that everyone knows is the drama kid, the person that's always giving speeches for student council that never gets voted. And I gave my speech, and I don't remember how it read, but I remember it was me saying, don't be a sheep. Vote for someone that you know truly cares, and that is themselves, and they want to see that in everyone else, and something like that. Or basically, I felt like it was kind of like my coming out speech without saying that I'm gay, and I won. Like, I remember, and that's why I still talk about it to this day, because I never in a million years, like Jordan Bowman and Jimmy Fleet and like whatever Dustin, like I was like, I will never beat these guys. And this little poor black kid from the south of Atlanta who gets bussed up here every day was a senior class president of Roswell High School. And I was myself in doing it. And that's one of the important lessons that I think makes me successful today on the radio is that's when I learned you will find success when you are yourself.
That's such a great lesson that you learned early. Yeah. To learn that in high school, not a lot of people do, because in high school it is molded to be like everybody else and just to do that. But you didn't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and it was, and I'm so thankful for that, because then that guided a bunch of other decisions throughout the rest of my life that sort of got me to this point, because I said, you know what? Fuck it.
Oh, yes.
I'm Miguel Fuller.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. I want to get back to the city by the bay.
Okay, get it, Holly. Yes.
It's my journey.
Wow. So, yeah. So, I have a bunch of other stuff written down, but I feel like I'm talking a lot. So, if y'all want to ask some questions.
No, I'm riveted. I like it. Like, damn it. I know this story.
Right.
Like, I know all this parts and pieces, but I'm still like, so then what?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. It's just that it's a good story. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why I love you so much is because it's so inspiring.
Thank you.
And, like, you just... people are drawn to that because you can be yourself when a lot of other people have a hard time doing it. So how do you do it?
Ooh, that's a good question. How do you do it? wow.
Because you know what?
That's a good one.
How do you do it? And how, like, I know that, you know, people are drawn to people like yourself who can just be themselves regardless of, like, we're people pleasers, Miguel and I. So you are yourself, but at the same time, you also want to make sure people like you. That's just in your nature also. So how do you be yourself, but also all these people like you, and you try to please people, but also be yourself? How?
Wow. I'm trying to think about that. You know, I think that, I got it. I'm myself 90% of the time, because of the people pleaser part of me, there are parts of my personality that I feel like I crafted when I was in middle school to sort of, I was like, okay, so, and I've never talked about this before. I remember being in middle school and saying, like, okay, everyone likes Betsy Bates. Like, what is it about Betsy Bates that she likes? A lot of people like James DeLahunt. Why do they like him? Like, what are the most, sought after personality traits of that person. And so then I said, well, maybe I need to do that. So I need to be thoughtful. I need to be this, or I need to be that. And so I sort of incorporated that into me, like just being a kind person. And then as I got older, I met people in my life in college that were like really funny people. And I sort of was like, okay, well, I know Jake Jewell responds to people like this and he's really funny, so I can incorporate that. And so all of those things sort of like seeped into my soul and made me who I am. And so to me, I feel like if I live out those characteristics, who I do feel like now as a person who's 30, like that is who I am. But I learned those traits, and I think because I live the, like, to me, having those traits makes me be who I am, which also makes me a likable person because I took the best attributes from those people over the years and melded them into myself.
So you're sort of a shapeshifter.
Yes. Definitely.
No, I'm not kidding. Like, I consider myself to be a bit of a chameleon.
Yeah.
And you are too.
Yeah. I mean, and that's why I say, like, you know, like with my boyfriend, I'm like, you know, you see one side of me. But there's, like Holly saw when I lived with her, that there's this whole, like, curmudgeon.
Yeah.
Like.
What I was getting to, too, is that what you're about to say is that you're 90% of the time at work, especially, which is where most people see you, either in the building or out when we're with listeners, is that 90% kind, funny, outgoing, you know, compassionate person, which you are. But you're also insecure, angry,
yes,
a curmudgeon,
yes,
crotchety sometimes, antisocial, which when I say those words, if you just know Miguel on the surface level, you're like, that can't possibly be, or they only see like little twinges of that, and maybe they think that's like a bad day for you, but that always rests under the surface somewhere.
Yeah, that's always, because I feel like in my life, I've always lived it as like, you know, the world is your stage.
Sure.
And so I, and since I was in middle school, I mean, I remember when I moved from Denver to Atlanta, or back to Atlanta, and I remember when I was getting to meet these new people, and I remember walking into the cafeteria because that's where they placed all the kids before the bell rang. I remember every morning I would stand in front of the two big wooden doors where they had the little metal plates, and I would think, okay, be Miguel that people will like. And then I would open the doors, walk in, sit down, and be like, hooja cooja, hey, ha ha, mm-hmm. you know, and be that person. And so I had to sort of put on my armor and be the person that I thought people would like.
Yeah.
And so I feel like as an adult, I still do that because, you know, I don't always want to, like, go out and be social and, you know.
Yeah.
Like, that still is in me because I like being around people. But I would not mind at all. Just sitting in my house by myself watching TV.
Yeah.
I'd be completely fine with that as well. So there is that sort of juxtaposition in my personality where it's like, who is the real Miguel?
But I think the real Miguel is all of it.
Yes, they are. They're all. Because I need all of those to feed who I am and make me happy. I need all of those things.
Agreed.
Wow.
Jared, so you got something? Because I'm about to move on to the next one.
Well, like, the stuff I have is after high school. Because
okay.
I don't know a lot of the stuff. So I'm learning as well as people listening right now are learning.
Yeah. So. Well, so then I think another moment that sort of solidified my sort of my toughness, I feel like. I feel like you could throw anything my way. And I would like to think that it won't faze me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first 2 years of college at South Georgia College, where it's a small, tiny two-year school in Douglas, Georgia, a town of like 500, it feels like, where they have a Walmart and a Wendy's and a Ruby Tuesday. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I lived on campus, and I was so scared, and I was so nervous, but I was so excited to start afresh and to start anew. Well, I became friends with the RAs as soon as I got there, and one of the RAs that was a sophomore was caught drinking because they were the RA on the softball floors, and so they got fired, and so I had made friends with the other RAs, and so they were like, do you want to be an RA even though you're a freshman but you seem mature? And I was like, okay, that's cool. And I feel like that is like a hallmark of my life that I never really think about the depth of what I'm about to get into. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, let's do it and see what happens. That first year was awful.
Mm.
It was awful. I still have a box full of things that they wrote on my wall, on my door. Like I have this little like license plate with like back in the early 2000s, they used to have like little bunnies with like funny saying, like,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
like sarcastic sayings yeah. over them. And I had one on my door, and then like they used to tack stuff on like leave second floor faggot, which they spelled faggot wrong. You know, we don't want you here, you know, take your, you know, go back to Atlanta. Because then I also was the editor of the school paper when I was a freshman, and I used to write these like articles about like,
you are ridiculous, just so we're all clear. Go ahead. So you're a freshman in college. Not only are you, did you accept, or you shouldn't have, the position of RA, probably, but then, shaped you. Right. And then what are you writing about?
I had a column called Miguel's Soapbox. And okay. So I would write these articles basically about, I remember the one that they got mad about on the floor is about how you need to have common courtesy if you live in a dorm, and how you shouldn't leave your hair clippings everywhere, how you should flush the toilet, how you should not do all this stuff. And I look back at that Miguel, and I think to myself, I was so brave.
Yeah.
Because I would basically look those guys in the eyes and be like, fuck you. I earned my right to be here, and you're not going to torture me. There were moments, I remember one night in particular, because they were all drinking, and I was like, I mean, I can't stop them from drinking. I'm just going to like turn a blind eye because I don't, it's like, you know, midnight on a Friday night, and there's no adult supervision here. So I'm just going to, you know, hopefully nobody gets hurt and pretend like I'm asleep. But I remember I went to the bathroom, so they heard that I was awake. And because this was like old school dorms, like the bathroom was like, you had like the bathroom in the middle, and then like the dorms all around it. And, you know, you had two people to a dorm, but I had my own since I was an RA.
Mm-hmm.
And the showers were public. And I remember going to the bathroom in there, and they heard that I was awake, and I went back, and they just started like It was sort of like a scary movie. Like, they had their softball bats, and they were, like, dragging them around, like, the walls. And they were like, we're going to get you, faggot. And I was like, oh, my. And this is, like, I didn't have a cell phone then.
No.
So I was just, like, stuck. And I remember thinking to myself, let them come in here. Let them come in here and pull some bullshit. I'm not going to walk out of the room, but let them come in here and try to do something. And they never did, because they were just drunk and being dumb college kids.
Right.
But I look back at myself and I'm like, how in the world was I so defiant? And I was just so like, I'm going to change this campus. And so by the time I left that school, I feel like that's when I learned my voice of advocacy and thinking that there's something in me that wants to be a leader, that wants to be strong for other people, and that wants to stand up for other people. So by the time I left, I had started a Gay Straight Alliance at the school. I had started a Young Democrats Club. I had directed a play, and I started an improv troupe, and I was the student government president. So, like, I did all these things that I felt like I wanted to leave. You know what? I think I wanted to leave there with those kids knowing that a gay black man can do better than you, not just as good, but better than you Southern fuckheads that are here. Sorry.
Oh, my.
We are fully bonded, licensed, and insured.
Okay.
Sorry. That I could do better than you. And so that was sort of like what, that's why I did so much there. But I had a great time. But that's when I sort of got my, like, my full wind in my sails to sort of be like, okay, you're on the right course for life.
Might I say the term trailblazer?
Oh.
I think that would be the term where you would pick up that in your cache of adjectives that describe Miguel Fuller. That would be the time in your life when you picked up trailblazer.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
Okay, keep going.
So
what's the next part? What's the next turning point?
So basically, and then this is when we get into radio, is when I graduated from South Georgia College and I went to Georgia Southern, and that's when I started my broadcasting degree. And I also, when I first got there, I started working in the newspaper, but right across the hallway was the student radio station, 91.9 The Buzz. And I would always peek my head over there and be like, hey, do y'all need something? And I did like a two-night-a-week shift where I would be the DJ, and the person that Holly and I used to work with, Kramer, that's where I met him. Mm-hmm. And he, like, I did better than everyone else from the very get-go. But he did tell me back then that I would never be in morning radio. He told me that I was not good enough for morning radio. Asshole!
I love when you had to bring that story up. That's a good one.
Because I remember we were in the parking lot, because I looked up to him because he was a senior and I was a junior just coming in from a 2-year school, and he was the program director. And I remember after he sort of showered me these accolades, and that second semester of my junior year, they decided to, instead of doing a morning show, they did some big survey on campus and noticed that most kids listen at night. And so they wanted to start a morning show, but at night. And I was chosen as one of the hosts of it, out of like the 30 kids that had started that fall. And after we were like going through like getting a name for the show and all this other stuff, and I was like, do you ever think I'll be able to do a morning radio show or host a show? He goes, no. He goes, there's just no way. Just your humor. Yeah. No, you couldn't. And I was like, well, damn.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. That's fine. But, and this is where I learned to trust your gut.
Mm-hmm.
And to also to trust your gut and do what you know is right. And so by the end of that semester, it was called Buzz Late Night Live with Spanish Michael, Jamie Lynn, and Average Joe. And we were on from Monday through Thursday nights from 7 till 11. And that was so much fun. I think about that. And like, when I look back at that time, I wish that I could tell Miguel right now, could tell that Miguel, like, I'm so proud of you. Because the bits I had my co-host Jamie Lynn, we did like a whole blind date thing with her on the air over the course of a week. And then we sat on a blind date, and then like we recorded it and like played it back. We did a makeover for our Average Joe guy and had listeners come in and a salon donate the makeover. Like, I did all that stuff when I was a junior in college, and that I actually knew that that would make good radio.
Yeah,
it's
like
crazy to me.
They didn't teach us that at our college radio station. Not only did we not have shows, but we didn't. That just wasn't even a thing, and I didn't even know it existed. I didn't know.
Well, see, and I mean, a lot of the things I did is I would think. Because I listened to The Burt Show in Atlanta, and I would always think, what would The Burt Show do? And so that was sort of always my filter in looking for things to do. And then as the semester went on, I became popular on campus. And not like, you know, ooh, he's the football player. People listened to the show. Mm-hmm. And so when I would go into like the study hall, or this is when I remember I was like, I'm hooked on the radio bug. I remember the beginning of my senior year, we decided to do a morning show. We called it The Morning Buzz with Spanish Michael, Jamie Lynn, Tony, and Brian. And I started a class, and the teacher was going down like, oh, you know, Miguel Fuller. And this girl looked back and goes, are you Spanish Michael? Because that was my honor name at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah. She goes, oh, my God, I love you.
Oh, wow.
And then like three other people in the class said that. And then I was like, oh my God, like, do I know what I'm doing? Like, could this be a career for me? Mm-hmm. And so that was my first little taste of like notoriety and sort of people and like seeing how radio can affect people. And that year also, we had this big hostage standoff situation in our school.
Man.
It was crazy. We called it, was it 2000? Yeah, it was 2000. We called it Hostage Standoff 2006.
Oh, man.
And we literally did 24-hour coverage. And in those moments, like, I eat it up.
You shine.
I love it. Like, I was on air all night with my co-host Jamie Lynn, and we did like reports. We had Courtney J, Statesboro sweetheart, on the scene interviewing people. Like, girl, you couldn't tell me shit at the time.
Oh,
I was so excited. So all those little experiences at that little college radio station, like, that infused that bug of radio and just wanting to entertain, wanting to enlighten, and wanting also to educate people on what was going on and inform them. And so just my time at 91, those 2 years I was there, just absolutely fantastic. I loved it. So
that makes me happy. It's just so cool that that was the experience that you had so early in college.
Yeah.
That you thought to even be like the Burt Show. That's so cool.
I mean, it's crazy. Like, I still have some of my my show sheets that I had that I made up back
like
then.
Like, you had a damn show sheet.
I know. It's crazy. And, like, I would put, like, for Jamie Lynn, I think we called it something Hollywood. And, like, I said, it said Jamie Lynn Tease Hollywood Story.
God, that's nuts.
Like, how the fuck?
I don't know. How the fuck did you know? Because I did not learn that until I was solidly in a morning show and they sent us to a boot camp. Like, I didn't understand how it worked. But maybe it's because I didn't listen to the radio the same way that you did growing up. I don't know. So you already knew in your head that, like, that's how you do it.
Yeah.
And you thought to emulate those people. So then when you, but did you always know that you wanted to be in morning radio and you were just going to bide your time until you could find one? Because when you got out of college, you just were doing like part-time work and promotion stuff, and which is what you do.
Yeah.
Believe me.
To.
Like,
yeah.
That's what you do. So like, how did you think it was going to go that you would maybe make it to a morning show?
I knew sort of, cause I mean, from the high school, I knew I wanted to be in radio. I wanted to do a morning show. And so I knew, thankfully, I feel like because I'm just a humble person, that I knew I couldn't walk out of college and be like, I'm hosting a morning show in Tampa Bay.
Mm.
Like, I knew I was going to have to bide my time and, like, be a promotions person
put
and be
part-time
and be an assistant producer and then maybe be an executive producer and then maybe one day get to be second chair and then maybe host my own show. And so I knew that. And I remember thinking to myself, all the people, and at that time, because this was in, what, 2007, 2006, I was like, everyone I know that is super successful that I look up to in radio are in their 30s. And so it's going to take a decade for me to get there.
Yeah.
And so I sort of like put that on in my psyche and said, well, now you just have to sit through this hell and get to it. And when I, after graduation from college, I have thankfully got a job at Clear Channel in Savannah, and I did that promotions, and I produced a news talk, conservative news talk morning show. That was the worst.
Not your favorite moment?
No, not my favorite. And then I did overnights on the top 40 and fill in. And I just sort of, and that's when I learned, I've always had a hard work ethic, but that's when I learned to really be detail oriented, because my operations manager, John Weatherby, who is actually a weatherman,
which is amazing.
And that is his real last name, yeah. John Weatherby. He's actually on WTOC. He's the assistant chief meteorologist at WTOC, the news leader in Savannah.
Delightful.
I work there as a production assistant part time. And so he taught me how to look over everything. And that's one of the things I always hope to teach interns when they work with me. Is the one thing I want you to know is to double check yourself and be detail oriented. And so when I miss stuff, that's what makes me angry, is because he had a lot of jobs. Like, he had to do a lot, because then he had like his own weather business, and then he worked part time at the news station at then starting doing weather reports on the weekends. And like, he just was a work machine, but he never dropped a beat. He never missed anything. And so then here I am, like, you know, making $20,000 a year as his assistant, and I would, like, forget shit, and I, like, oh, damn it. I would forget stuff, and then I was like, okay, I have to. If he can have all these jobs and not drop the ball once, I need to get my stuff together.
Yeah.
And so that's where I learned the lesson of having to be detail-oriented and get the job done correctly. Because then people will be like, all right, I want you to do more stuff.
And I can trust you.
Exactly.
So you learned, that was a good, so he was the one that taught you all the business end of it, I guess.
John Weatherby at WTOC.
Good stuff. Yeah. Okay, so then, so that kind of brings you up to when you did get to be on a morning show.
Yeah, so then when I got to Panama City and Kramer brought me and Holly, you brought me and I moved in with you without knowing you at all.
Which is that, like, when I think about that and we share that story with people, and people are always like, that's weird. It really is. Like, it's crazy, but it's just, it was supposed to happen.
I mean, it was. Because basically, real quick, backstory, you know, I knew Kramer from our time at The Buzz at Georgia Southern, and then he got the opportunity in 2007 to work in Panama City at Island 106. 6 months after he was there, Holly applied for the job as co-host, and they brought her down from Ohio. And then 6 months after that, they brought me on to be the producer third chair. And we didn't know if it was going to work. And I just moved right on in with Holly, and it worked.
Yeah.
It took a while.
I never think to myself, like, things aren't going to work. Like, I just am like, oh, this is what I'm doing. And right. It's not until I get to, like, a certain moment that I'm like, oh, shit, maybe things aren't going to work. Like, I don't ever have it in my head. I'm like, oh, well, this is just my next step.
Right.
So, yeah, and it's a lucky thing that it did, like,
especially
for you and I, because that could have been terrible. Could you imagine living with someone that you, like, the amount of time that we saw each other in a day, it was probably, like, aside from sleeping, 16 hours.
I mean, we really, Jared, like, we would do the morning show, we would go to lunch together, we'd go back to the station to get more work done, then we'd go home, we would take naps on the couch in the living room together, then we would wake up, and then we'd decide what did we want for dinner, then her then-boyfriend, now ex-husband Chris would come over, we'd cook dinner together, still talking, and then we'd eat dinner, still talking,
yeah.
And then watch a TV show, still
well,
talking.
Don't forget we had to plan the show for the next day.
Oh, then plan the show, and then we would go to bed. So there was like no time. We spent apart. Like, that's insane.
Ridiculous.
You guys have a civil union, actually.
We do. Technically, we're married. So
pretty much. So
anyway, well, that's good. So, I mean, so then, and I know this so well because obviously that's when I came into your life. I don't just know it from you telling me. I know it from seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
But you always said that you wanted to host your own show.
I did. That was always my goal when I came working with Kramer, is that I wanted to do my own show. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what that looked like, but I just knew, and I did know that it would take something special for me to host my own morning show, because as a gay black man and as an open gay black man who will not hide that fact, I will not be me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I knew it was going to be difficult, but after, you know, we left Panama City, came to Tampa with Holly Kramer and I, and then we got fired, and then I went back to host an afternoon show with our old intern, then producer, Mandy. That's when I got the shot to host the show, and I was scared shitless. I was so scared because after being a third chair and a producer, where at the time, like, I love Kramer now and we're friends and I'm going to go visit him and his wife soon in San Diego. At that time, he was not the best in praising the people that helped him be successful. And so I didn't think much of my talent and I didn't think that I could do it.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I was making a decision if I should go back to Panama City to do my own show. And I think I called like 9 people and all these people were like, do it. What are you talking about? This is what you've been wanting. And I was like, I don't know, y'all. Like, I had to be convinced to do it.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually one of the things I had written down, because like we wrote down some stuff before this was I don't know the guy. I've never met Steve. Mm-hmm. I've only heard things about him, mm-hmm. good and somewhat not so good.
Mm-hmm.
Was there one thing that brought you to that point where you're like, I can't work with this guy?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. That's a good question, Jared. High five.
Yeah, that was Jesus.
Because keep in mind, after we got fired, the Kramer Show tried to go and do things on their own. And then I left, which is another story altogether. Doesn't mm-hmm. matter right now. But then Kramer and Miguel were going to do their own show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we thought about shopping our show. Here's why I didn't want to. And this is what one of the reasons why. After I had to remember what my original goal was and sort of believe in myself. When we went to Tampa the first time, there was this whole, like, really awkward situation where money came into play, where there was talk of, like, how, like, when you do a morning show, and I don't know if we can talk about that. I don't know, whatever. Basically, we have an agent, and that mm-hmm. agent negotiates one number. And that number is then divided up amongst the show members with contracts.
Right. Think of it as a pie. They go in and get the full pie, and then it's split up into different pieces.
Sure.
The way that was presented was sort of, I felt like in an ambush, and I didn't feel like I got my fair slice of mm-hmm. that. And I never got over that. And that sort of was the root of a lot of problems on our show when we were in Tampa, which I don't think it seeped over into the air, because I felt like the three of us, I feel like Kramer, Holly, and I could walk into a studio and we would jump right back into it and it would be a fun old time.
Oh my God, yes. We should do a reunion show podcast.
Yeah, it would. It would be fun. It would be great. But at that time, it was so, like, I remember, like, everything that he would say. Like, he'd be like, oh, my wife and I are going to do this. And I'd be like, must be nice because you got X amount of dollars than I did.
Yeah.
And so when you sort of have that on your mind, it's hard to come back from that. Now, looking back and, like, sort of being in his position, I still don't think it was right, but knowing who he is and where he comes from and his influences, it makes sense, because at that time for him, it was a business decision. Now, what we do on this show, The Miguel Show, yes, it's named The Miguel Show, but I look at Holly as my equal. And so when our contract negotiations came, it was a completely different story. And I remember him saying to me in private, he goes, well, when you host your own show, you're going to understand. Now, I think he understands where I'm coming from now, because he's gone, like, he lost his job, he was out of radio, mm-hmm. and he's apologized several times for, you know, all the craziness that we all, you know, that he put us through. And so he understands, but I think at that time, I couldn't do it. The thought of, like, being, and I hate that, because I feel like he's one of my best friends now, but at that time, I didn't like him a whole lot. And I don't even think he knows it that deeply.
Mm.
But so I was like, it's back to Panama City. And there was a lot of people. Our agent told me that my career was going to end. I remember being on Omerton, going into the subway. He called me and he goes, so what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to Panama City. And he goes, your career is over. He goes, you're done. You're done. And I was like, okay. And once again, that was one of those moments where this is a guy who's been in radio forever and mm-hmm. knows everyone. And as I was 26, I was like, I got this. I know what I'm doing. But I was scared. But I felt in my soul that I needed to go back and mm-hmm. I needed to hone and I needed to learn what it takes to put on a show.
Sure.
So did that answer your question?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's it. It's been long.
It is long. I feel like we just talked work, though. We didn't get into any personal stuff about, like, relationships or anything. Mm-hmm. But
that's true. Yeah,
did you want to touch on any of that?
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit, and then we have to go. I'm trying to think of how to sum it up nicely. I feel like right now, in this moment, I have been more at peace with sort of my failed attempts at connections with people, because I don't even want to say relationships, because I haven't had many of those.
Right.
But I feel like a lot of times I would try to connect with people.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I think, crying in the Hot 101.5 studio after a guy that I had started seeing when I first moved here. And he was like, I'm not really looking for anything. And then like a month later, I saw on Facebook that he was dating someone. And I remember thinking to myself, I think I'm going to be alone for the rest of my life. I just don't think that anyone can. It makes me sad that I thought this at one time, but I actually thought to myself that I'm not good enough to be loved by anyone.
Mm-hmm. That's about as deep as one person can. As low as one person can feel about themselves, because that's what we all want as mm-hmm. humans, is to just love and be loved.
And I felt that there was something wrong with me, that it just wasn't possible.
Yeah. Do you feel that way anymore?
No, I don't. And I can't pinpoint what's changed. Because I think obviously this relationship I'm in now has helped. But even before that, I think after sort of sitting with the thought that I would be alone forever and that I'm not good enough to be loved, and then after sort of like doing some soul searching and being like, no, I am a good person. Like, I can do this. And I can't think of any sort of one moment that made me change that. But then I will say, though, there are still times that I still think that. So it's not like it's completely gone away.
Yeah.
Because even when I say it, it still, like, it hurts.
It hurts because you don't really believe it deep down. And that's your other voice. Like, you know how you have, like, who you are, but then you also have your voice that tells you stupid shit?
Right.
Like, yours is so deeply ingrained, I feel like, that you mistake it a lot for you.
Mm.
You mistake your voice for you a lot. And
true.
So that's the voice that's like, nobody can love you. But I think you as a person, I hope, know that you are deserving of love and that you will have it one day, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But that other voice that's like, it's you. It's not them. It's you.
Right.
That you are so used to it, it sounds like your own voice. And you have a hard time differentiating. And when you're going high like you are right now,
right,
it's like the real you has kind of nudged that to the side a little bit.
No, it's true.
But that voice, the voice in all of us, the critic,
mm-hmm.
you know, that negative voice. Man, I forgot about all this for a second. I'm so glad we're talking about this, because I got to go read some books that I had forgotten about. But that one is a killer, because it'll make you doubt yourself.
No, it does. And I think that's a lot of I really think outside of, because I always, you know, as a gay guy, I go back to like, well, it's because I'm overweight or it's because of this. But I really think, no one wants to date someone who doesn't believe in themselves. No one wants to have to be your constant cheerleader.
They don't want to be the crutch. They want to be with if they are a whole person,
mm-hmm.
and that's giving them a lot of credit, because we all dealing with shit.
Right.
But like, if they're a whole person, they don't want to be with a person who needs to be pumped full of
mm-hmm.
Affirmation every day. They want to be two whole people coming together to mm-hmm. share a relationship. You're not two halves making a whole.
Right.
You're two wholes coming together and trying to do this together. And so if you're not whole, if you're not even of yourself, all of it, believing in it, why should they?
Right. No, it's true.
And so if you're with someone for enough time, you can kind of start to see that, and you're like, I like you as a person, but I can't fill you up.
No, it's true. And I I know that, because there is a guy that I was into, remember Chad, over a couple Christmases ago?
Yep. Yes.
Yeah. And we were like talking for a little bit, and then I found out that he tried to get a threesome with someone that I know, and that person called me, and that was like the surface level stuff of it.
Oh, Jesus.
But like, since then, we've become friends.
Sure.
And after a failed relationship this summer, I remember I called him, and I was like, now that we're 2 years removed from when we were like talking, can you honestly tell me, like, what it is that made you not want to be with me? And he said, to be honest, I saw it when you were drunk. You needed this, you needed to be boosted up. You needed this confirmation, this affirmation to be given to you. And he was like, I'm not that person. Like, if I think you need that, I'm gonna call you dumb and walk out of the room. So I thought it was best for me to just remove myself from the situation so maybe one day we'd be friends.
Mm.
And I, you know what? I think that was the eye opener. That was the, now that I say that, because I think that was after the Alex situation when I first got here and after all that went away. That's exactly what it was. I totally forgot, because that's when I learned that truly my slow self-confidence was truly affecting my love life. And that's why I had been unsuccessful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what it is.
Because you were going after something that you didn't have yourself.
Nope. Exactly. So that's what it was.
Brilliant.
So...
thank you. Well, thank you for bearing your soul. I'm so glad our prologue went well.
Wow, that was good. This is 50 minutes.
That's fine. Listen, wow. it is a very intense and riveting 50 minutes. Yeah. If I wasn't me, I'd still sit through all 50 minutes of it. Now, if the damn thing shuts off halfway through, I'll probably just call it a day.
Well,
but hopefully not.
That's what's great about it is that now we have the podcast on the website.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have to, you can listen on the app, but you can also listen to it on the website and you can like download it and listen to it at your leisure.
Oh, praise. I didn't know you could download it.
I think so.
Yeah, you can.
Download it. Hopefully maybe we'll have iTunes soon.
I would love iTunes.
My friend Andrew is working on that.
Is he still?
Yeah. Yeah. I think he's going to host it on a server. So we'll see.
Okay.
I have to pay him some money, but we'll
Give you some of that money. I want that iTunes.
Come on, girl. Producer Jared, I'm curious.
Yes.
How was this for you? Because Holly and I are very much the same person.
Well, that's what I was about to say, is I've been relatively quiet the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
Because like I said, I'm learning as Stacey and Largo is learning. I'm learning at the same time somebody else is.
Yeah. Right.
Because, like you said, you guys have been together to the point where people go, you two finish each other's sentences, sit down. Like, I'm learning as everybody else is learning. So it's very, it was very interesting because okay. I knew some of the stuff, but I didn't know all the stuff.
Mm, interesting.
So would you say, because I'm like sitting here, I'm like, that was so good. Was it though, or am I just biased?
No, it was. It takes you into a look of who the person really is. I mean, there was a lot of stuff we said, I want to say probably about 20 minutes in, that made a lot of sense of how you come across to people.
Mm-hmm.
It's much of what you were saying with the relationship kind of thing. There's Miguel that's inside his house just watching Oprah, but then there's the Miguel that you see at the store, and they're two different people because you're looking for something.
Mm.
It's not what you're trying to put out there. It's what you're trying to get back from people. You don't want people to see that like not lonely kind of Miguel, but the person who's just sitting in his house, who's very standoffish at times. You right. want people to see what they see on the air, because it does feel good with everybody. What you get praised from somewhere where you're sitting in your classy GSE and someone went, oh my God! Like, that's the kind of stuff that I've heard this because I'm much of the same way, and I bet everybody in this building's the same way, is to be in radio, you have to be somewhat fucked up.
Yeah.
Because the only reason we're doing this is for praise.
It's true.
Yeah.
That's what I tell my boyfriend that, because he's sort of going through a metamorphosis on his own and learning how to be, to sort of like, because you want to be yourself, but I feel like you can't be that curmudgeon person all the time. You have to put on a game face sometime. Mm-hmm. And he goes, I just don't understand how you do it all the time. And I'm like, I literally get paid to make people like me, that in turn like the radio station, that in turn give us money to buy advertising on it. That's what I do. That's what my job is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel I'm good at it because I've made it to this point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It, you know, so yeah. So you're right. That's crazy to think that's what our job is. So, well, good. I'm glad it was interesting.
It was.
I'm good. I can't wait to hear Jared's. That's going to be fascinating.
I can't
know about that.
Yes, it is. Yes. I'm so curious.
Oh, show.
But next week, Holly, you're on deck.
Okay.
The prologue, the Miguel Show's prologues, Holly O'Connor, she will be next week. All right. Well, we are done. If you have any questions that you want for Holly to answer, you can email me, miguel@hot1015tampabay.com. Producer Jared, what's all your social media?
It is Producer Jared on Snapchat, Nervous Jared on Twitter and Instagram as well.
Holly?
Radio Holly for everything.
Mine is Miguel Fuller, M-I-G-U-E-L-F-U-L-L-E-R. Until next week, bye!